Well, I really didn't want to know. I was happier not knowing about football players who beat up their families, but now is not the time to turn away. Good morning, I'm Bill Radke. Welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. This hour, how do NFL abuses connect with Seahawks fans and a Washington senator? Is Metro being honest with you about its finances? Why did the Northwest love Mars Hill and then drop Mars Hill? And a question for you. This week, the U.S. House passed a bill discouraging people from buying marijuana with welfare benefits. Is welfare weed a problem worthy of congressional action? Why or why not? I will share some of your answers from our Facebook page later this hour. Or if you're more of a Twitter person, you know we're at KUOW. And we hang around by the phone, 206-685-2526. That's 685-BLAM. Our guest this hour for the Week in Review, Joni Balter of Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel, also a Bloomberg View columnist. C.R. Douglas is political analyst at Q13 Fox News. Luke Burbank hosts the TBTL podcast and Public Radio's Live Wire tonight. Hey, everybody.
Hey.
Hello.
Good morning.
Hi.
Welcome. Thanks for coming in. I guess the news was dominated by world events, the Scotland vote. Not as interesting as had hoped for those of us with nothing at stake way over here. Secretary of State John Kerry promised we're not entering a ground war in Syria. How is this for some very impressive hedging?
At this moment, no country has been asked to put boots on the ground, or no country is talking of it, and we don't think it's a good idea right now. So there's no discussion of that at this moment.
At this moment, at this time, right now, anyway. And then there was the big domestic story. Unfortunately, it was again this week, the NFL, which is scrambling to keep up with public opinion of players who punch their wives and beat their children. Just to recap quickly, I know we've heard it all week, but one star player convicted of assaulting his girlfriend, another is charged with assaulting his wife and child, another knocked out his fiancée in an elevator. She did not press charges. In fact, she married him. And another is indicted for hitting his four-year-old son with a tree branch or a switch, depending on who you listen to, hard enough that the bruises alarmed the boy's doctor. Luke Burbank, you are a serious Seahawks fan. If, and he's not Ben, to be clear, if quarterback Russell Wilson were accused of assault, not convicted, would you want him immediately benched for the entire investigation, even if it made this a losing season?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
I think there's a problem with the NFL's current policy, which is that if someone has only been charged with something, they're still allowed to play. Well, in the case of this guy, Greg Hardy, who has not yet been convicted, the public pressure has gotten so great that they've actually put him on this weird, like, purgatory list where he is on the team and getting paid, but he's not on the roster.
Right.
But basically, the NFL's policy has been if the charges are not have not been, you know, sort of tried out, I guess, in court eventually, like, we don't have a verdict, we can't do anything. But I would say, of course you can do something. Like, how many people in this room have been accused of domestic violence this week? I'm thinking like zero of us. Mm. And I think if you work at a radio station and you are charged with something like this, the radio station would take a long, hard look at if you were doing a great job representing the station on the air, even if it was only allegations. So I think the NFL just, it's a weird rarefied air in the NFL. You make a lot of money. You're really famous. The normal rules don't have to apply in that. I think it's okay to sit someone down even if there's just an allegation. And then if it's not true, let them play again.
Should you lose your – anybody disagree? Do you lose your rights if you are famous and rich and in a sort of a quasi – it's almost like you're in – like you're a celebrity. You're in the entertainment business.
Well, I would just say that this idea that they have a policy this week seems kind of funny to me because they seem in search of a policy, and they have an announcement after this show of some sort on their domestic violence policy. They are
the commissioner, right? Roger Goodell's going to say something in
say
a couple of hours?
Because he's a little worried about his job just a tiny bit.
Mm-hmm.
But they're over there in PR heck, I think we say on the radio. Mm-hmm. Is that how we do it?
That's all we can say is
yeah, that's
heck.
All we can say, yeah. PR heck. And so they're over there trying to figure out how to handle this incredible mess. Because the NFL, as everybody knows, is big bucks. Anybody want to guess what the number one TV show in America is?
You mean the number one through
two and
three?
Yes, exactly. That was the punchline.
Oh,
but
well,
there
sorry,
it goes.
Johnny.
You know, Sunday night, Thursday night.
Yes.
Wait, Monday night Thursday
football.
Night, Sunday night. There you go. So it is big business. They've got to figure this out. They'll probably come out with some kind of zero tolerance policy. That's just a guess, but something like that. And how to get out of this nightmare that they're in, that because their policy's been so weird and hard to follow.
Yeah, you call it a nightmare, but they also have the top three rated television events of the last week. So, I mean, I'm still watching my fantasy football team with great interest, despite my disappointment in how Roger Goodell handled things. And I think that's probably where most football fans find themselves.
Mm-hmm.
It is a problem about when in the course of an accusation, a trial, you know, a verdict,
appeal.
You mete out your punishment if you are the NFL. And yeah. They have been all over the place on that. I mean, Ray Rice has not been convicted, right? He's getting punished. Some people have been convicted, have not been punished, or got light punishment. So there's a huge inconsistency here. They actually have a much more consistent drug policy mm-hmm. than they do a domestic violence policy. That is going to change. It will have to change. There's a ton of pressure, not to mention sponsorships on the line if they don't get this right. So they're figuring it out. They're stumbling their way through it. But I suspect, you know, in the next couple months, they will have it figured out and they will be more consistent.
So is this a blip or will this extend to – what about a player who verbally abuses his kid or cheats on his wife? Or
the wife cheating thing would be pretty much game over for the league.
Yeah.
So let's keep that off
empty
the table
field.
For now. Yeah, they'd let me play.
Okay.
Well, there are rules in the NFL for things like assault. So it's not just – it's not just domestic violence that would have got you in trouble this week. So I don't know about – what was your – was your lewd remark or was it
– Yeah, well, I'm just wondering where this extends. You could also say, does this extend to we talked about these players as entertainers, and they are. Should Mel Gibson be banned from making movies and you know,
well,
Sean Penn.
Perhaps
and
in England today, but yeah.
this King County Council member, Reagan Dunn, who just pled guilty to drunk driving, and he refused to take the breathalyzer. Okay, Ray Rice, what Ray Rice punching his wife was horrible. She's not pressing charges. In a sense, it involves the two of them. Drunk drivers kill thousands of people. You know, Reagan Dunn could have killed somebody. Do you see any change? Are we just this is a blip because there was a confluence of events, or are we changing our minds about what we'll accept from people who we have the ability to kick out of their jobs?
I thought about this too. If there had just been the one incident and then the rest of the week was quiet on this event, I don't know how this story would have played out. But the fact was there was this confluence of examples. And so the story became just bigger and bigger. And, you know, every day there seemed to be another revelation, which gave it this, oh, my gosh, this is one of those turning point moments. We've got to face this head on. We've got to do something to make it different. If there had just been the one incident, I wonder how the news coverage and sort of the ebb and flow of the story would have gone.
Well, as a matter of fact, we have a Washington Senator, Maria Cantwell, on a different topic, but it's sort of like all coming together for the NFL. She has one of the sponsors of a bill to end the tax-exempt status for the league. And that's because of the name of the Washington, D.C. football team. She says that the name Redskins is a racial insult. She's one of many to say that. Does that punishment fit the crime, CR? Your hand is up.
Probably not. I mean, she's doing what public shaming hasn't been able to do, which is to get that team owner to change the name. So she's pushing this tax-exempt issue.
By the way, who was shocked to find the NFL is tax exempt? I did not realize that was the case until we went through these stories this week.
Yeah.
What?
Well, just to be clear, it's the league itself that is tax exempt, and then the teams pay taxes.
Right. The league itself does it. The league is a trade association,
right,
which a lot of them are tax exempt,
right.
But except Roger Goodell, the head of the league.
A lot of money.
The league doesn't bring in a lot of money. It's not a lot of money to be taxed, except Roger Goodell makes a whole bunch of $74 million in a two-year contract.
It sounds more outrageous than it is. I mean, we talk about this $9 or $10 billion league, but most of that money, it's not as though that's not taxed. Most of that money gets funneled back into the teams, and the teams are individually taxed. Mm-hmm. So If you actually took their tax status away and required them to be like a normal for-profit operation, the expectation is that you would at best raise $10 million a year. I mean, that is not a ton. And the NFL probably would have ways to, you know, find a bunch of tax exemptions, and you may even get less than that. So the NFL is, despite this, you know, that it would not probably hurt them hugely financially, they are pushing back at this. I mean, my guess is Maria Cantwell is not going to get much traction on this. Her game here, the play here, I think, for her is to at least get a hearing on this, to kind of public shame them one more time, make the NFL come to a Senate room with a whole bunch of lights and TV cameras and explain, you know, why they should get a tax exempt status, why you make so much money, why you don't have a domestic policy, why you still have the Redskins, and then you know, public shame them, and hopefully they'll do better.
That's Coach C.R. Douglas diagramming Maria Cantwell's play here on Friday Morning Lights on KUOW's Week in Review, and we'll be right back after a break. With Joni Balter and Luke Burbank and C.R. Douglas and you, I'm Bill Radke, and we're looking through the week's news, finding what's worth remembering and what we can learn from a little bit. King County Metro Transit says that it will not have to cut so many bus routes after all. Metro says it found some savings and only has to cut 400,000 bus service hours per year instead of 550. Here to help us talk about this, a special guest, Seattle Times columnist Danny Westneed. Hi, Danny.
Good morning.
Thanks for coming in. In a moment, Danny.
I did not take the bus. I drove.
Otherwise, you drove.
I probably wouldn't be here.
Wow. That'll come up.
Those are fighting
broken
words.
But unbowed.
Indeed.
After the Metro guy called you out, huh?
Danny, in a moment, how dare you write about your privileged experiment of voluntary bus riding, you victim-blaming Volvo driver. But first, when Metro said it would have to cut 550,000 hours, was it lying to scare us into giving it money?
Well, I'm not so skeptical to say that they were lying, because that's such a strong word. But I think it was pretty clear that when the voters said no, they went back and did exactly what the critics and the skeptics said that they could do from the beginning, which is they went and found more efficiencies and savings and so forth. And they've now eliminated. Originally, we started on this. I think they said they were going to cut about 600,000 hours, and this was portrayed as sort of a big crisis for mass transit in the region. And that got reduced to 550 because their sales tax revenue is going up, and now it's been reduced again. So we've already gotten rid of about a third of the problem after the voters said no. So, I mean, my bias, and we can get to this from my 3 months of bus riding experiment.
Oh, we will.
Is that we need dramatically more transit. We probably could double the number of buses and still wouldn't have enough in some places. And so the fact that we've been debating these sort of apocalyptic cut scenarios and threatening the voters, like, vote for this or we're going to cause this crisis with mass transit, it strikes me that the entire debate is about the wrong thing. They should have come up with a plan to actually tell the voters, hey, here's how we're going to improve the system. And, you know, they didn't do that. And understandably, the voters said no. And so now here we are. We're kind of back in a similar situation. Then now Seattle's rushing in and saying, hey, this is a crisis. Let's go out to the voters again. But I still
In November,
just in Seattle only. But mm-hmm. I still haven't heard anyone make a coherent case for how transit is going to be improved by us voting yes.
You just helped and hurt the cause in the same breath there, it seemed like to me, because...
Thank you very much.
And that was good work.
Impressive.
So there you go. So they shouldn't... And Bill Radke and I did talk about this on the radio.
I remember.
You don't lecture/threaten voters. They'll vote no because they don't buy it. But on the other hand, if you're gonna actually now improve service, you gave them the campaign line. So, you know, we're not going to scare you as much as we used to, but now we're actually, and it was in your column. Now they might actually add service, which is really where the fastest growing city in America maybe needs to go, right?
Yeah, but they're talking about that sort of retroactively. But there still is no one saying, here's how we're going to improve, say, service to my little pet peeve, to South Lake Union. We just plopped 30,000 new employees in South Lake Union via Amazon, and we didn't do anything to prepare for it, when it comes to mass transit anyway. So I just find that to be incredibly bad planning, and I still haven't heard, I've now heard in this last couple of days overtures of like, oh, maybe we can add service, but they don't have any plan to actually do so.
But those 30,000 new people, if you think about it, are also the reason that sales tax is growing. So it's working both ways there.
Does anybody figured out what percentage of the people who are paying the taxes or voting on these various measures are actually taking the bus, give or take? Because I'm somebody who lived in Seattle for years, was not a bus rider, and every time the topic of Metro comes up, it's kind of an abstraction for me. And I feel like that's how it is for a lot of people that don't take the bus. If you take the bus and you rely on it and you know which lines are packed, or as you call it, the late, which buses show up, you know, historically after they're supposed to be there, then it's really personal to you. What did Tip O'Neill say? All politics is local. It's really local to you. But if you're like me and you're not taking the bus, it's hard. I understand that it's good for a city and I know it should be there for people, but I just don't get jazzed about it. And I feel like that's part of the problem, is a lot of people aren't taking the bus and don't really care about it.
Man, you're even more of a privileged elitist than I am.
I wrote the book. Look at this Audi key fob I brought into the studio. I mean, this is conspicuous consumption.
They were really trying to finesse it at the press conference earlier this week, trying to show that they had done reforms, if you will, squeezed a little money out of the system so they didn't have to cut as many routes. But on the eve of the Seattle vote, they also don't want to look like they've solved the problem. So they're sending the message that we're getting better, but we're still in a hole. I suspect it's still going to – it probably doesn't matter what Metro says or does. This will very likely win in Seattle. It won in Seattle if you take the April vote and just sort of pull out Seattle precincts overwhelmingly. Seattle is kind of – is a city that seems to just love its bus service, and it doesn't have near the skepticism with the agency as the wider county does.
Unlike Luke Burbank, who also doesn't live in Seattle anymore. So here's what I want to know, Danny, about this column you wrote for which you got a lot of guff. Why did you get so much guff?
Well, I don't know. You'd have to ask the guffers about that. But the reason I wrote the column is because, unlike Luke, I've, going back to the late 1980s, frequently taken the bus. And I've also had long periods in my life when I didn't take the bus. But I lived for a number of years without even owning a car, and so I was reliant on the bus. And Seattle's always been a difficult city to get around in, but despite being sort of slow and annoying, the bus always worked. That was my baseline impression of it. And so when my car broke down in May and I started taking the bus and ended up taking it through the whole summer, I was quite surprised. I was stunned at how dysfunctional, at least getting to and fro from South Lake Union, was. I mean, literally standing on the street in lines of people, sometimes 35, 40 deep at a single bus stop, and a bus would finally struggle up completely loaded with people and none of us would be able to get on. And so then we'd have to wait 35, 40 for the next, and then half the people would get disgusted and walk away. And it just, they're completely overwhelmed down there. And
the only thing that would make that image better would be if the bus sprayed you with water,
exactly,
and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Well, wait till fall.
Yeah.
So what would it take for you to actually sell your car? You got your Volvo to ferry your kids around. Is there anything going to happen in Seattle that would change that conceivably ever?
Well, I don't know.
You're not a young man.
I mean, we're the fastest growing city, big city, like Joni said, but we're also an incredibly rich city. Doesn't this seem kind of third world to anybody else? Shouldn't we be able to solve how to run a bus system? And yet the political debate about it is still like, oh my God, it's a crisis. Please give us more money or else we're just going to slash service. And I just find it to be a huge disconnect. We have one of the world's fastest growing and richest companies down in South Lake Union. The place is booming. There's cranes on every corner. And yet we can't run buses there?
And by the way, we can't save all our old icons, which I want to segue to. We're going to go to break in a moment. But before we do that, I want to talk about this This icon, if you're under the age of 50, I promise I'll make this interesting to you. A beacon of Seattle history is homeless. It is squatting on top of the old PI building, and it's going to get kicked out. This is the 19-ton, slowly spinning iron globe that says it's in the PI. The obvious spot for it would be on top of the Museum of History and Industry. But when Ross Reynolds asked the museum director, Leonard Garfield, about it, he did not sound excited about housing this particular bit of history.
You know, our building, which is the Historic Naval Reserve Armory, is actually a city landmark, as is the globe itself. And so the notion of preserving a landmark may preclude sticking a gigantic globe on top, but perhaps nearby our building or in some other park.
So to keep the History Museum historical, we have to keep it how it was historically and not put something historical on it. So what do we do with the PI globe? Anybody?
Put it in the sculpture garden, floating water park.
That's good stuff.
Put it down near the hat and boots.
No.
Do those exist?
Good.
Are those gone?
I think they're gone, aren't they?
No, they preserved them. But they preserved them.
They're in a little park.
Ruby Chow Park, I believe.
Down in Georgia.
Oh, they moved them.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Somebody's got to save that thing. I mean, that is like top five icons of this city. I'll put it at my house.
Yeah. Port Townsend.
Yeah, I mean, I would guess not really keep with the local scene there, but I'll do it if I have to.
Hasn't Mohai agreed to be the custodian of it?
No.
They haven't?
No.
Who wants it off the building where it's at currently? Because that's also a really cool thing to have on top of your – with somebody like, you know what? Our building is too noticeable and interesting. Let's get this out of here.
Especially down there. Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
Are there any bits of Seattle history that you think are overrated? And if it's old, we should keep it? Or there's anything you would just let go?
Now, we talked about this in the green room. Uh-huh. I'm willing to let go of the R.
You're not into
the R.
Your
last name is Radke, so I feel funny
saying hard for,
that.
It's a hard one for me. But what do you have against the R, the Rainier
Nothing.
R?
You just asked us to dispense with one, and that was the one.
I do feel sort of cheated by the R. I feel like it's sort of phony now.
Mm-hmm. And so, thank you for that support, Dan.
I do. I drive by it, and I loved the old R, and then the T came, and that that was really
It's
lame.
Like we got divorced from the R. We saw other people, and now we're back together.
I know.
But it's like there's some weirdness.
Exactly.
I say anything meant to be wacky. Like, I never was into the pink tow truck, because it just seemed like, well, it's it didn't seem like it was ever authentic. It was just, okay, we'll make a pun, and it's an ad. And
plus, I was often retrieving my car from that lot.
Yeah, that's
I had
tough
bad
one.
Memories.
Really bad memories of that place. No joke.
I'm not a lover of the ducks, but meaning ride the ducks.
Yes, not into that.
I'm not into that for some reason. I mean, I'm happy, I guess, that tourists have a way to get around, but I cringe a little bit every time they drive by.
Is it because you feel pressure to do a wacky dance or whatever the person driving that thing is instructing the people to do towards you?
I do cringe that this is the first experience some of these visitors are having of Seattle is the wacky duck drivers.
You know what it is? The tow truck is a pun. No saving puns. That's my rule. How about the statue of Christopher Columbus that was on the waterfront for like 30 years and they had to remove it because it was constantly being defaced? The travel guide Roadside America calls it the world's ugliest statue of Columbus. It goes on to say, Columbus, whose face resembles one of the bug-eyed aliens from Close Encounters, is regarded by some critics as the ugliest statue in the world. The statue was rejected by the Seattle Arts Commission, but the Seattle City Council overruled them and installed it in 1978. It was the first statue by local sculptor Douglas Bennett, who said he had wanted to depict Columbus as gaunt and worried. Bennett reportedly never received an offer to sculpt again.
Well, now they're trying to get rid of Columbus Day entirely.
And that's where we're going in a few minutes on KOW's Week in Review. Well played. Hey, should we put the globe on the Seattle Times building?
Well, I thought maybe Seattle Times could take one for the city and just put it up there. A lot of people are still angry at us for defeating the PI.
Exactly.
So, yeah, maybe we should.
Put it in CenturyLink. Put it over where they, like, raise the flag. Just, you know, another cool element of that stadium that we could just make it, you know, unique.
Luke Burbank of LiveWire and TBTL, a PI Vanquisher, Danny Westneat. Thanks for coming in, Danny.
Thanks for having me.
And C.R. Douglas and Joni Balter, and I'm Bill Radke, and we're going to get back at the Week in Review in just a moment. K KUOW's Week in Review. Good morning. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in. This week, the U.S. House passed a bill sponsored by Washington State Congressman Dave Reichert that could make it a little harder to use government welfare payments to buy marijuana. Supporters call it the No Welfare for Weed Bill. It would prevent you from using government-issued welfare debit cards to make purchases at stores that sell marijuana, just as you cannot use welfare debit cards at liquor stores right now. We asked you on our Facebook page whether this was worthy legislation. Kate says, really don't think welfare money should be spent on pot, alcohol, cigarettes, especially if there are children to support. Anybody disagree?
No, but this is sort of symbolic legislation here, if you think about it, because all they're doing is saying this specific card can't, and the ATM, I guess, in the pot store, if there is one, can't be used. But hello, you can take the same card over to the other cash machine and get the cash and show up, and that's going to be a faster transaction anyway. So, really?
I mean, it's housekeeping, as you say. You already can't, by federal and state law, use it for liquor, for strip clubs, for tattooing.
Casinos.
Casinos. Mm-hmm. I mean, basically the seven deadly sins are outlawed.
And buying your stripper girlfriend a tattoo is really out.
Verboten.
So I think it makes sense to add this. I don't think he's going to get much pushback.
Should we be here's what John says on our Facebook page. If your life were in such a horrible condition that you had to go on the disgusting, cruel, punitive, classist program we call welfare, buying you some pot is the least this country can do for you. Should we be telling should we be telling welfare recipients what they can spend their money on?
Yes, absolutely.
No. Why?
Because we're giving them the money. And I'm not somebody who thinks that welfare is a bad idea. I actually really think a safety net of some kind, however incomplete it is a really important thing in a society. But I think we as the society also reserve the right to tell people. I grew up as a kid in a big family. We didn't have a lot of money. We used WIC when I was growing up. And the rules with WIC were you couldn't just, you know, Women, Infant, and Children, it's a program for milk and cereal and things that are important in early life. And the rules are you can't just get like Fruit Loops or Frosted Flakes. There are actually rules about what cereal you can get, or at least there were in the 80s. And so what I would do is I wanted Cocoa Puffs, but the best we could get would be Kix.
Yeah.
So I would reverse engineer Cocoa Puffs by getting chocolate milk,
which
was allowed for some reason, and Kix.
There you
and
go.
Make it into a kind of, you know, as much as I, as similar as I could get it. But anyway, I do think that it's okay for the society at large to say we want to help you. We want to try to, you know, give you food and a little bit of money to help get by. But we don't want you to get out of the ATM at the head shop, you know, and that's reasonable.
I agree, and I mean there is this phenomenon that if you wanted to go get cash somewhere else, I mean the fact of the matter is if you needed to buy alcohol, you probably could.
Well, should we ditch that and not make the debit card an ATM? I mean, you can get anything you want at the store with a credit card. It would be easy for the state to regulate what you could swipe and buy. And not make it
a cash card.
It just
makes it less direct. It just makes it that you're not going to take that card into that casino, liquor store, now pot store, and use it directly. Obviously, folks can turn anything into cash, this specifically into cash, and go do whatever they were going to do.
And we should clarify for folks that don't know, the EBT program will allow you to have, there's a certain amount of cash every month that's on this card, and there's a certain amount that's set aside for food. And so people can use this card to get, again, not a large amount of cash throughout the month. That's what's at issue here, I think, you know, is getting money out of the ATM on their EBT card.
Right. Should we require drug testing to keep your benefits card?
No.
I'd be fine with that.
No, I don't think so.
Gone too far?
That's
gone
a tough too one. Far. That's a tough one.
Well, Congress, by the way, is not going to do anything about it. Dave Reichert. From Auburn, I guess you'd say, was the one who sponsored this, one of the sponsors. And it made it through the House, but
wasn't it also brought up by some, I was reading in the article, I believe it was co-sponsored by somebody in a state that hasn't decriminalized marijuana, some other random state?
Yeah.
It seemed to me like, oh, this is some Republican somewhere who was just, you know, mad.
Scoring points?
Yeah, just kind of like finding a paper tiger to take on this scourge of people, you know, spending welfare queens on weed. And he's from like New Mexico or something where this is not even a real issue.
Right. At our Facebook page, Brian, agreeing with some of you, says, I can't imagine the people on welfare are rushing to buy weed. This sounds like a tedious piece of legislation that will cost more to enforce than it's worth. We, coming up on KUOW's Week in Review, we're going to talk Columbus versus Indigenous Peoples Day. In fact, we're going to talk with an Italian-American who does not like how things are going down in the city council. Stay tuned. KUOW's Week in Review. Hi, I'm Bill Radke, and I'm with Luke Burbank of the TBTL podcast and Public Radio's Live Wire tonight at 8 o'clock.
Indeed.
Thank you for that. Season opener.
Yeah, very excited. We have Melissa Etheridge on the show. We have a cancer doctor named Dr. Brian Druker, who is influential in the drug Gleevec, which has had a real positive impact. And the theme of the show is Trailblazers. And so for this show, we went out and hired the actual PA announcer for the Portland Trailblazers to introduce our guests. So if you think you've heard Melissa Etheridge introduced on stage, you haven't heard her introduced at 5'1" out of the Berklee College of Music. It was actually really fun.
Luke Burbank also doing double duty this week on Wait, Don't Tell Me. Tell us about this later, will you?
Yeah, please.
C.R. Douglas at Q13 Fox News. He's political analyst there. And host of Civic Cocktail on the Seattle channel is Joni Balter. Hey, Joni.
Hey, yeah.
So continuing on with KUOW's Week in Review now, we want to talk about the Seattle City Council, which held a public comment this week on changing Columbus Day to Indigenous Peoples Day. In attendance were, among many others, members of the Order of the Sons of Italy in America. The Seattle Weekly quoted Sons of Italy member Tony Anderson as saying, "We're shocked that you would even consider desecrating the legacy of the Italian Americans who built this country. You are slighting all Americans and Italians and our civic rights and ethnic heritage." That's Tony Anderson of the Sons of Italy. Tony, welcome to KUOW's Week in Review.
Thank you, Bill. It's a pleasure to be on with you this morning.
Good to have you. First of all, what do you do in Seattle as a member of the Sons of Italy? Tell us about your group.
Well, our organization has been around since 1905, and our goal is to continue building and our ethnic heritage, continue the generations and with our Italian heritage. And you know, Columbus Day is just a great way for those of us who are American Italians to continue to build what he started in 1492.
Well, let's talk about what facts we can agree on, Tony. Do you acknowledge that Christopher Columbus enslaved the indigenous people he found, forced them to work in his gold mines until they died of exhaustion, supervised the selling of native girls into sexual slavery? And unfortunately, I could go on. Do you dispute that part of the record?
There's a document that I sent to the city council. It's facts and fiction about Columbus. And the facts are that Columbus never owned any slaves or brought any slaves to the Western Hemisphere from Africa or anywhere else. For people to say that, that also is appalling to those of us who are American Italians. If we're going to talk facts, let's talk the facts. But let's not bring in things that are untrue and or propaganda.
Okay, council member, my panel has some questions for you too, Tony. But one more thing from me. Council member Nick Licata is a Seattle City Council member, is Italian-American. He's in favor of Indigenous Peoples Day. And as he told you at this hearing, Italian-Americans are not represented by Christopher Columbus. Do you disagree?
Well, I'm not too fond of that council member. He's not a very good Italian. I'm sorry.
Not a good Italian.
But let me say this, for the record. How many days do we have to recognize in a year Indigenous peoples? You know, on September 26th, we already have Native American Day in Seattle. November 28th is a national holiday, American Indian Heritage Day. Also, let me say this. I'm a very proud friend with a lot of Native Americans in the greater Tacoma Pierce County area, in the Puyallup tribe. Former chairperson Herman Dillon was a real good friend of mine, and he's one of the major players, as I stated the other day to the city council, from the Native American community across this country that brought forth and helped get the Lands Claim Act in 1990. He and I were very good friends. I have nothing against recognizing indigenous peoples, but how many days throughout the year do we have to do it? And what's the purpose now of trying to pit the indigenous people slash and or Native Americans against Italians?
That is exactly what I wanted to talk about here. I think that if the city council wants to do this, and forgive the number of days, sir, if you will, they can have Indigenous Peoples Day, but why does it have to replace one? So it's sort of just making this comment on history, and you know, clearly there's a dispute about the history in some way here. Bruce Harrell had this sentence. I think we may have talked about it before. He didn't want to do this action, getting rid of Columbus Day and replacing it with or adding it to the same day. That was unclear what they were going to do on that. He wanted 20 cameras in the room. You know, so one thing for the city council to do could be, you can have Indigenous Peoples Day, but why make it against the Italians? And I say that as someone who lived in Italy and I speak Italian, but not that well.
You are a good Italian, Joni.
No,
Tony, would you agree?
Not one bit.
Oh, I agree wholeheartedly her. And, and the other thing that Council Member Harrell said the other day is that after the people spoke and they're sitting around the table, that we were invited prior to that committee meeting to have the opportunity to say we'd like to sit at that table. I want to state for the record that Council Member Rasmussen is the person that responded to my initial email. Not once was I communicated with as the leader of the Order Sons of Italy in America for our Grand Lodge of the Northwest. Not once was I asked to sit at that table.
We have time for one more question for our guest, Tony Anderson from Sons of Italy. SCR.
Well, my quick question is that it seems like Columbus Day is not recognized here. I mean, you go to New York, Boston, San Francisco, they have these huge parades, you know, almost like the Macy's Thanksgiving Day parade. I mean, Columbus Day in Seattle feels like this old antique in your attic that is collecting dust and not being used. And so my question is, why are you not using this day?
Well, exactly. You know, and we should, as Italian Americans in the Northwest, get back to celebrating Columbus Day, organizing a parade again. Let's put back our Christopher Columbus monument down on the waterfront in Seattle that was removed and is somewhere in Seattle storage.
Somewhere.
And so I say to all the Italian Americans here in the Northwest and the different organizations, let's form a greater Italian coalition. Let's work better together as a unit, and let's create Columbus Day as a greater day here in the Northwest again. But we have to work together as a team to make it happen. You know, the city of Dallas right now is having their inaugural Columbus Day parade. They've never had one before, but now it's starting in Dallas, Texas.
It could happen again in Seattle. Tony Anderson from the Order of the Sons of Italy in America. Tony, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you much, Bill, and thank you to the rest of the panel.
So the city, is there any doubt that the city is going to go from Columbus Day to Indigenous Peoples Day? Is that still in doubt?
I'm pretty sure they have the votes.
It feels like it's not in doubt to me.
Yeah.
And listen, we're a city that's not using this as it's been used in other places. He claims he wants to try, but we're also a city that is named after a Native American leader. So I think it's pretty...
The biggest city in the country.
Pretty clear it's going to happen.
Can't we just have two pretend holidays?
Right.
I mean, seriously.
Give the kids the morning off, you know?
Throw them a bone. Throw everybody a bone.
But that's what I was...
Luke Burbank, Joni Balter, C.R. Douglas, Bill Radke with KUOW's Week in Review. And coming up, Mars Hill, the incredible success and the rapid retreat. That's next. Should we get Councilmember Nick Licata on, who just got called a bad Italian
right now?
Yeah.
What's your recipe for cannoli? Right now, Licata.
Put it down, or the man's comments stand.
Yes.
Our producer, Jason Pagano, you guys all know each other, right?
Yeah.
You get, he's shaking his head. This is KOW's Week in Review. Just funnin'. I'm Bill Radke. Seattle's fabulously successful megachurch, Mars Hill, is in retreat. The church is closing its downtown and university district locations next month, saying attendance has declined significantly. The church's very charismatic pastor, Mark Driscoll, is accused of plagiarizing a pastor for one of his books, for misusing church money, for misogynistic remarks and general bullishness. This week, University of Washington comparative religion professor James Wellman talked to us about the surprising success of Mars Hill here in Heathenville.
In a culture like the Pacific Northwest, where, you know, 70% of us are unchurched, there's a huge, vast market of young people who are not going to church. So if I were going to plant a church, I would plant it in Seattle.
This is an interview he did with Ross Reynolds, and Wellman talked about Mark Driscoll, how he espouses very, we could call it traditional views on gender roles, but Wellman calls it a complementarian view, that men and women should have distinct complementary roles, which is controversial in the Northwest, maybe, especially to church outsiders, but to young people, that is the kind of social rules they often crave.
I think one of the interesting things about this generation is that they're so often growing up in homes that are somehow disrupted by divorce or something else. And there's no real sense of boundaries. I really think those boundaries he provided.
Luke Burbank, you're shaking, you're nodding your head, yes. Yeah. You grew up in an evangelical household.
It's interesting. My parents met on a religious commune in Northern California called the Lighthouse Ranch in the 1970s, and they were probably in exactly the place where some of the people who really locked into Mars Hill were at, coming from chaotic families and in an era where there weren't a lot of boundaries, and they found it very reassuring to be part of a movement where there were actually, even though it was hippie sort of Christianity, it was at its core, not unlike Mars Hill, a very conservative kind of dogma that was being taught about men being the head of the household and women submitting to their husbands and things like that. I can see the appeal for people with Mars Hill because it was a pretty slick package as well, because you had kind of rock and roll pastor who would wear t-shirts and play movie clips during the sermon and sometimes, you know, let an occasional swear word out. You know, it was very relatable to people.
Mm-hmm.
But again, at its core, it was a very pretty conservative kind of, you know, doctrine they were teaching.
And how surprised or not are you at the fall of Mars Hill? Not that it's never going to
totally
bounce
unsurprised.
Back, but, yeah.
There's a life cycle with evangelical churches in my experience. The one that I came up in is a shadow of what it once was. They had churches all over the country and in other countries as well. It's really back down to just kind of Eureka, California, where it started out, and a few other locations. These churches are usually built around. I went to a church when I was a kid called Living Way Foursquare, which was after my parents' church kind of closed. Again, very charismatic pastor, was doing great. Charismatic pastor runs afoul of the flock and church shrinks. This is because these things are so often built around one person.
Yeah.
It's very easy for them to fall apart when that person turns out to be a human.
Yeah, this religion professor, James Wellman, who we were just hearing from, he said that Mark Driscoll, he described him as brilliant, funny, very knowledgeable about the Bible, but he said after a while, he stopped listening to the church elders because, as you say, it's all about him. Yeah. Other panelists, what do you make?
To me, it felt like that. I didn't know about that natural life cycle, but that's exactly what it seemed like to me, that this is market-driven. So you have a big, huge presence of a person who captures everyone's fantasy. The church grows and grows, and it's, oh, my gosh. But what's that line of flame that burns so hot can only burn for so long? And so the other side of it is going to be that he starts to fizzle because people start finding out things about him that are not appealing. And so, like the market, now everyone's, I'm not touching that place.
But I don't think this was inevitable. I mean, this could have gone on a lot longer. There was a big appetite for this. And as Luke says, this tapped a kind of a different vibe for Christians. This was defeated not because of some dogma, not because of sort of something ran its course. It's because this guy you know, could have easily broken the law, maybe, but certainly he was using money inappropriately. He was treating people inappropriately. I mean, this was just kind of garden variety bad behavior.
But if the church is so rock solid in its faith and with its followers, why not? It's not Mark Driscoll. It's the assistant Mark Driscoll steps in. You have the church.
And see, that's the thing. For somebody to have the, you could say, audacity to think that they should stand in front of hundreds or thousands of people each week and tell those people how to live their life, to interpret the scripture, interpret God's voice, that is a person who, you know, they would probably use the terminology feels led by the Lord. But that is a person who I think is, again, fairly audacious. And that's also the kind of person who then probably wants to live the rest of their life along their own terms as well, which how they use the church money, how they talk to people. It's like the kind of person who can start a Mars Hill is unfortunately the kind of person who can run a Mars Hill into the ground.
It's a bit of a classic tragedy that way. I mean, your big virtue ends up being your downfall.
So do you think we're so unchurched, to finish this out, in Seattle?
By the way, that's a term I hadn't heard before.
But unchurched?
I like it, unchurched.
De-churched.
Yeah. De-churched. Well, now there's been some de-churching, apparently.
Do you think this is a one-way arrow, or do you think that there is a – look at the yearning there apparently is, the God-shaped hole, as they say. And do you think that with the right combination of people and approaches that there could be a new life for religion in Seattle even?
Well, for a church like this, yes, clearly there's a market because these folks came and they enjoyed
it. Now there's
a
diaspora as well.
Right, but they came and they wanted something like this. Then they were disappointed by what it really turned out to be, of course, but sure, there's an appetite there for another one to replace it, something like it, but not quite like it.
I don't think this is ever going to be the Christianity capital of anything, but sure. I mean, this could cycle back. That number could go up.
You know who else was riding high a few years ago? Look at your rundown for our week in review topics. Tim Iman might be on the way back, and we'll get to that in a moment on KUOW's Week in Review. C.R. Douglas, Luke Burbank, Joni Balter, we're doing the same thing you are. You're a busy person. We're compressing in an hour the week's news to find out what was most interesting and memorable. And if you don't know who Tim Iman is, who I just referenced, welcome to Washington State. I hope you're enjoying the Evergreen State so far. Tim Iman is on the way back, though, with another statewide initiative. C.R., will you remind us briefly who Mr. Iman is, and then what's he up to now?
Well, he's a guy that's been running initiatives for probably 15 years, most classically the kind of anti-tax initiatives, limits on spending initiatives. He's ventured into other things. Those other things have let him down in the last couple of years. He has not had much success at the ballot, so he's trying to be relevant again. He's trying to make a comeback, and he's found an issue he thinks that'll do that, which is to basically make a uniform minimum wage throughout the state. So don't allow cities to freelance like they have been doing in Seattle, in SeaTac, and others have been considering. Everyone's got to play by the same rules. Everyone's got to, you know, live by the state mandated wage set in Olympia, which right now is $9.32 an hour. He thinks this will get a voter interest and, more importantly, big benefactors. He needs a couple million to actually run these initiatives, and this is starting to look interesting to some people, meaning some big, large donors.
Thought it was pretty interesting, the mayor's response to this. Think about this. $15 minimum wage is the mayor's signature accomplishment so far this year. And here comes Tim Iman, and it has always been that way for Mayor Ed Murray, because he was in Olympia, and here, whatever he did,
this is his nemesis,
the 2005 gas tax package that was put on the ballot, and Ed Murray feels that his side won, which it did. So over and over again, there's going to be a Tim Iman thing, and the mayor goes, bring it on, which is kind of I was surprised to see that, but I thought that was kind of interesting. Now, if you're living, let's say you're living in Spokane or Vancouver, or you're saying to yourself, okay, so I hate Seattle. Sure, got that. But
why do you hate Seattle?
I don't know.
East-West divide.
Thank you. Do you want Do you want there to be a precedent that if you go to your city council and you get something, who knows what it is, maybe it's a higher minimum wage, do you really want someone, initiative guru Tim Iman, to be able to go to the legislature and have them say, everything you just did locally, bye-bye, we're not doing that?
I don't think that people's brains work that way with relation to this issue. And my wife and I live in Port Townsend now. I have been in various parts of this state outside of Seattle after the $15 went through. I can't believe how many people talk about the $15 an hour minimum wage in Seattle who are not living in Seattle. It has captivated the imaginations of the rest of the state.
How do they talk about it?
With great derision.
Yeah.
Honestly, it plays into this notion that Seattle is this liberal bastion where just everybody gets paid this huge amount of money. It just, for somebody who does have a bit of suspicion about what goes on in King County, this $15 minimum wage was just like, it was just a fastball right down the middle to Logan Morrison. I'll use a relevant reference because he hit a 3-run home run last night.
In the ninth inning.
One game out of the wild card.
I should have been sleeping.
But I couldn't. That is red meat to people that have suspicion about this part of the state. I don't know why it is, but I've had in dive bars, which is where I do a lot of my research, many people bring this up. I could see Iman getting a lot of votes, even though it has limited impact on people in other parts of the state.
But don't those people in the dive bars want also their city to enact $15?
They want another drink. And then after that, they would like
or
that's
to have
the way
more
to
money.
Get the
or
other
they
drink.
May not want 15, but they want 12, or they want 13, or they want to do something that's tailor made for him. I would say that despite the fact that there is going to be some anti-Seattle, anti-15 sentiment that Luke talks about, this just strikes me as going to be a little bit tougher initiative than Tim Iman's classics. I mean, his best game,
Tim Iman, all my best,
is when he's demonizing state government. Do not give state government more money. They're evil. They'll spend it badly. Da 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 da. Here, the demon is really low wage workers. It's a tougher sell, I think.
We, believe it or not, have 50 seconds left of this program. C.R. Douglas from Q13 Fox and Joni Balter, Seattle Channel, Civic Cocktail, Luke Burbank, master of so many things, TBTL, the podcast.
Involved in many things.
Fair enough. LiveWire tonight at 8, and you're on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on Saturday, which you taped in Seattle.
Yeah, we taped at the Paramount last night. It was really hard because we didn't know what the Scotland vote was going to actually look like. So here's what we had to do. We did one round where we pretended like they stayed together, and then we stopped, and we told the audience, we're going into a multiverse here where they didn't stay together, and then we did the whole thing without them staying together, which was a waste of time because now we know they're staying together.
Freaky. Saturday at 11 o'clock?
That's your station.
Oh, yeah. Good point. 10 o'clock. Thank you, producer Jason Pagano, who puts this thing together. Thank you, Seattle Times' Danny Westneat, Tony Anderson from the Sons of Italy. Thanks for tuning in, everybody.